Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Daniel Ellsberg, is best known for leaking the Pentagon Papers, which played a key role in ending the Vietnam War. From the fall of 1969 to August 1970, he copied everything in the top secret safe in his office at the Rand Corporation. But the Pentagon Papers were only a fraction of what he copied. He also copied highly classified documents about the U.S. nuclear program. In order to hide them and keep them safe, Daniel Ellsberg's brother, Harry, buried them at a marked location in a trash dump, but a hurricane destroyed the marker and the documents. Well, here we are 45 years later, and Daniel Ellsberg writes about those documents and what he learned in his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. The book is based on Daniel Ellsberg's research on nuclear weapons and extensive notes, and those lost documents have since been declassified. He opens the book by writing, quote, "One day in the spring of 1961, I was shown how our world would end, not the Earth itself, but nearly all humanity or life on the planet," end quote. In his new book, The Doomsday Machine, he lays out those documents and his decades of research and asks many, many questions. How did the U.S. become a country with such devastating power and so little concern about using it? And how can this doomsday machine be dismantled? Daniel Ellsberg is the subject of the Oscar-nominated documentary, The Most Dangerous Man in America, and Daniel Ellsberg joins us in studio. Hi, Daniel. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you in studio, and your book is so amazing and so frightening on many levels. You copied these documents when you copied the Pentagon Papers. Most people don't know about this. Why now? Why did you decide to reveal what was in them now?
It isn't just now. I've been working on this for quite a while, but really,
or this book.
This book.
Yeah.
A lot of the book was actually dictated or transcribed, in fact, in discussions with my lawyers as to what might come up in my trial. Back in 1971, I wrote 500 pages of transcript telling them what my involvement with secret operations and activities in the government was, because they thought any of that might come in my trial, since I was charged with 12 felony counts of revealing secrets. So actually, I proposed to use that transcript as a basis for a book back in 1975 when the war ended. Until 1975, I continued to spend all my time really in trying to shorten the war. But when it ended, I did propose essentially this book. And it was for the first time and not the last turned down because no one would buy it. No one would want to read about nuclear weapons. As the editor said, we would sell 1,400 copies of this book. Mm. And I thought for a moment, and I thought, well, that's one for every member of Congress and some media people, and okay, right. And she said, no, you don't understand. That means we won't publish it. And she had no suggestions for what to do. So I really turned my attention to trying to help build a movement against nuclear weapons like the anti-war movement that had helped end the war. And with some success, actually, in the early 80s, we had the bilateral nuclear weapons freeze movement, which proposed to stop the development, production, deployment of new nuclear weapons at the high level we had, an agreement that would prevent, for example, Barack Obama's and Vladimir Putin's and Donald Trump's program of $1 trillion increase, basically, well, rebuilding of the doomsday machines that exist right now. But anyway, that would have been a time probably when I could have sold this book, but I was totally involved then in activism and trying to push the bilateral freeze and in lobbying. And that mood went away very quickly. When the Cold War ended at the end of the 80s, people thought the problem had gone away. And actually, any scrap of rationale for our enormous nuclear systems disappeared pretty much at that point, but the weapons didn't. Mm. And even though we have over the years now reduced them by some 85%, they were so enormously excessive in their ability to exterminate human life that there's been essentially no difference. Nuclear winter could still result from a small fraction of the weapons we have on alert right now.
Right now,
and
today.
Nuclear winter means near extinction of humanity.
It's so interesting to read about how you got your hands on these documents. You were so young, 1961, 30th birthday, and you got your hands on this single piece of paper, and it was headed top secret sensitive. Under that was for the president's eyes only. Before we get into these details, because so much is happening right now, and a lot of us can't remember what happened last week, let's go back in time and remind us about your position at that time in the government at a very young age and how you got that position.
I went to the RAND Corporation, which is a nonprofit working mainly and then for the Air Force in Santa Monica, California, from Harvard, where I'd done graduate work on decision theory, decision making under uncertainty. And RAND had done a lot of basic research in this issue, a very abstract issue of how do you make decisions when you don't know for sure the consequences of your actions. And, of course, nuclear war presented itself. We never fought a nuclear war. We had a one-sided nuclear war in 1945 when we had a monopoly of nuclear weapons. And our NATO plans, by the way, were based in the late 40s on a monopoly. They weren't to deter Soviet nuclear attack. We were the only ones who had nuclear weapons. They were what we would now call first strike weapons to initiate nuclear war against a possible conflict with the Soviets. But we didn't call them first strike because there was no possibility of a second strike by anyone, by us or anyone. We were the only ones who had them. We've acted in many ways ever since then as though we continued to have a monopoly. The idea of a nuclear war, vicious and annihilating as it would be if one party used them on a large scale, you could say made no sense exactly if there was a two-sided nuclear war in which both sides would practice annihilation of the other. And really, ever since then, we have pursued what Richard Nixon called a madman strategy. The threat that we were willing, ready, and able, certainly we were able, to initiate nuclear war under various circumstances, even though that would be an act of madness, an act of extermination such as the world had never seen. There's never been a time when it would mean either humane or, in the minimal sense, sane to initiate nuclear war in the way that each of our presidents has contemplated or threatened actually doing it. Right now, by the way, for the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which I participated 55 years ago in 1962, more than half a century ago, for the first time a U.S. president is threatening attack on a nuclear weapon state. North Korea, a state that can actually retaliate with nuclear weapons. Now, that wouldn't end life on Earth, initially at least, unless it escalated by a false alarm involving either the U.S. or Russia, like the Hawaiian one that we just had. Right. If in the course of a crisis or a nuclear war with North Korea, small as that would be compared to a war with Russia, if there was a false alarm of the kind that we just had in Hawaii, but one that involved the Strategic Command or the U.S. or the Russians or Putin, such as has happened in past crises, then, yes, then you could get near extinction. But with North Korea, what you're dealing with is the possibility not of billions dying, but of millions in a day or a week. A rate of violence in a day or a week that the world has never seen, ever, in the way of violence. And that's what we're threatening and contemplating, actually, in yesterday's New York Times. The number one column, the lead column, talked about the military preparing for a war they didn't want to fight, that they were reluctant. Let me put that another way. That suggests that, like Iraq, there is probably not a single active officer in the U.S. Armed Forces at general level or less, or colonel level, let's say, who's thought about these things, who believes it would be a good idea to be in a war with North Korea. And yet, conscientious, dedicated, and disciplined soldiers as they are, when they hear the president threatening such a war and talking about it totally, they're getting ready for it. And they would carry it out, no doubt, disastrous though it would be. To count on any of these people, I think, standing in the way of a president who is determined to do this goes against all our history. There's no basis for expecting that. It's not impossible. And yet such a person would be quickly replaced by somebody who would see it as his duty to carry out the commander-in-chief's desires. And as I say, probably not to the extermination of humanity, unless there was a big false alarm that involved Russia and the U.S. and one or the other thought that the other was joining in the conflict in a big way and led to our preemption. But it would mean a change in the world from which we would probably never recover. My book, of course, is based on the hope that people will wake up from this nightmare sleepwalking. Is that a phrase? Nightmare sleepwalking toward an abyss. Maybe sleepwalkers aren't in a nightmare. Maybe they're feeling confident in their sleep. But in any case, we're moving toward an abyss, and we have been, and if we continue, we will fall into that abyss. But I'm hoping we will wake up from it. If, however, there is a nuclear war, especially one which involves in some nuclear explosions in the U.S., which is more likely than not, in my opinion, if we go to war with North Korea, then the chance of dismantling these doomsday machines, I think, is put off for the foreseeable future, as far as I can see, until they are eventually triggered.
How serious are you taking the Trump administration, Donald Trump's, I should say, threats against nuclear, against North Korea and the tweets? How serious are you taking these? How serious do you think the public should take these threats?
Well, I take them very seriously, not in the sense that I'm confident they will be carried out if circumstances arise. After all, some of his threats, some of his promises he carries out, some of the worst ones, and some he doesn't. Simply not. We don't have a wall yet, for example. And the point is, I don't think it's zero. I don't think it's impossible. I don't think it's to be shrugged off. And if they're carried out, I'm saying the consequences are probably irreversible in terms of the way the world goes. Because I think, for one thing, that war would result very quickly in testing, a renewal of nuclear testing. That means that India and Pakistan, which now have only fission weapons, atomic weapons of the kinds that destroyed Nagasaki, like North Korea, would quickly get thermonuclear weapons, for which the Nagasaki-type weapons they now have are the triggers. The early forms of those would be 1,000 times greater in yield. Right now, a war between India and Pakistan, which I read last night, is being threatened by both India and Pakistan against each other. I just happened to come across that last night. Hadn't heard about it in the papers or the mainstream press at all. They're making threats like Kim and Donald J. Trump against each other. Their readiness to initiate nuclear war, especially Pakistan, which has smaller conventional forces. So they're making these threats. Right now, if they carried them out, they would lead to a reduction in sunlight, and we need to spell this out a bit, by the lofting of smoke from burning cities into the stratosphere that would reduce sunlight to a point where 1 to 2 billion people would starve to death by the shortening of harvests, the aborting of harvests, the lessening of the food supply in general. 1/3 of the Earth's population. If they get H-bombs, that changes to 3/3. The way we threaten if we had a war with Russia. The nuclear winter, which has been around as a concept since 1983, more than 30 years ago, has been confirmed in the last 10 years. And let me just spell out once again what it means. The effect of the smoke, not the radioactivity, the fallout, which we've heard about for 70 years now, or 50 years at least, not the radioactivity, the blast, which would be result, say, of one weapon from North Korea, as the Hawaiians were just facing, but the effect of smoke from hundreds of cities burning at one time, not just Oahu, as might have happened Sunday if the alert had been a real one. Okay, hundreds at a time will be lofted by the nuclear explosions out of the lower atmosphere into the stratosphere where it doesn't rain out, and where it spreads around the world in a blanket of smoke that absorbs the sunlight and blocks, in a large war, 70% of the sunlight. Essentially all harvests disappear then, are aborted or stopped or never get started. And we have winter-like conditions, like the earlier ice ages, essentially, for more than a decade. The supply of food for the Earth's population is about 60 days at any given time. Now, a lot of that is concentrated, for example, in the U.S. We would stop exporting, so the countries that rely on us for food exports would starve faster before we did. We would hold out months longer, perhaps a year longer, but within a year or so, whichever side went first would nevertheless starve to death. There would be no real difference between going first and going second, which is the whole basis of our strategic programs. Our weapons are designed, and the new ones are being designed, to launch on warning, essentially. This has been denied often, but that's the reality, that before enemy warheads arrive, get your ICBMs in particular, your intercontinental ballistic missiles, out of their holes and on their way to target, lest they be destroyed. What does this do for you? Nothing. But for 50 years, we've operated on the hoax that surely it must be less bad to be first than second. Actually, it isn't. And the reality of nuclear weapon, winter in particular, has made that very, very clear. So there's a kind of fraudulent basis here altogether that it's possible to limit damage by going first. And that's why these warnings, these false alerts, which have occurred numbers of times in the past, sometimes during crises, are so dangerous because of this totally false belief that one has to react quickly to them, even while they're still ambiguous, the warheads haven't arrived, you're not sure that it's happening, but you've got to react quickly. Whereas, in fact, I think any reasonable congressional investigation, of which there's never been one, any reasonable congressional investigation would show that the effects would be essentially the same, annihilating in both cases. Now, if I talk of a reasonable congressional investigation, that would require a different Congress, obviously, from what we've had and from what we have had. The Democrats, when they were in power, did not investigate this any more than the Republicans. I was very struck when you started, Rose, with the sentence, that, you know, my opening sentence from the book, because I've been struck, surprised a little that other reviewers have not, on the whole, fastened on that revelation of the first few pages, which is that even before we knew of nuclear winter, going back to 1961, 20 years before nuclear winter was discovered, the estimate of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is what I talk about in the first few pages there, in answer to the question of how many they would kill, we would kill, if we went first in our first strike, was, to the President, John F. Kennedy, 600 million people, 100 holocausts. And that included killing by our own fallout from our own attacks in East Europe, most of our allies, 100 million people in West Europe, depending on which way the wind blew. And in effect, we treated our allies as if, what, they were collateral damage, they were ants. We didn't have to care. We would be protecting ourselves, as, by the way, Lindsey Graham, in proposing a preventive war against North Korea right now, tells us that, and says the president has agreed with him face to face, that all the casualties would be over there. And he's talking about not just the North Koreans, who are, in effect, captives of their own tyranny, most of the people over there. He's talking about our allies, who would be annihilated by the North Korean retaliation. And by the way, and a lot of them by the fallout from our own attacks. And Japanese, in particular. And Chinese would be affected by fallout. But all those would be over there. And it's as if he's talking about those immigrants, I don't know if I can say this on the air now or not, but in effect he's saying South Korea and Japan are members of the shithole countries that we really don't have to worry about. He says, after all, the president is president of the Americans, and he would be saving Americans. Now, aside from the comparison that's involved there, he's wrong. It doesn't take an ICBM for Kim Jong-un to retaliate to an American assassination attempt or attack by killing Americans. It only takes a boat. It won't get here in 30 minutes, but it won't take 30 days for a container on a boat. It could even be unmanned, a radio cruiser of some kind, little boat, to go to San Francisco Harbor, where we are, or Long Beach, or Seattle, for that matter, and kill more than 100,000 people very quickly. And as I'm saying, I think the result of that, well, we've sort of seen how people reacted to the very thought of that in Hawaii on Sunday. Well, how about the reality? Would there be something that could be called democracy surviving that situation, as opposed to martial law? And essentially the turning the country into one large airport security system where you went through metal detectors and you showed identification and you were under constant surveillance, and there were large detention camps at all times and a lot of deportation. I think that's what we're talking about when we talk about a war with North Korea.
Listening to you describe what could happen is very difficult to comprehend. And I'm guessing that most people assume this could never happen.
Do they really?
I don't know about
really,
under this
really
man.
Think it can't happen?
Under Trump, maybe. But
their desire not to think about it's happening is right. Very understandable. And that's what, as I say, many publishers responded to. They won't want to hear about this. Right. Interestingly, thanks to Trump, that isn't true. I'm now ready to send copies of this book to a few of the publishers who the 17 publishers who turned it down because
17.
They couldn't sell any copies. But Bloomsbury is was enthusiastic about publishing this book from the beginning, and they've been very supportive of it.
You also note that a lot of people don't really understand this nuclear program. There's this idea that Trump actually has access to a button, or during the presidential elections, we always have that 3 a.m. phone call commercial. But you write that that's not how it works.
Well, yes and no. There's not a button. That's true. And moreover, the following is not the case. I think many people have an image in mind of how it should be and how they think it is, that there are codes. They talk about the nuclear codes that a president, man or woman, himself or herself, controls exclusively and which will keep the weapons locked up unless the right code is sent to unlock the weapons, basically. Nothing like that exists. Mm. There are, in fact, not in my day of 1961, but later, thanks to some efforts we made, what they call permissive action links, PALs, so locks on the lowest level of operating these weapons, so that it's not possible, in the short run at least, for a sergeant or a captain, Army captain or Air Force, to unlock their weapons exactly. But exactly how high are those codes kept? Definitely not at the level of the White House and not at the level of Washington or headquarters. After all, if that were the case, any enemy, even a very small one or a terrorist group, could paralyze our retaliation simply by hitting Washington with, in fact, it wouldn't take a nuclear weapon. You could even say that for some period, a bullet would put things out of action because only the president could release these codes. That has nothing to do with reality. The president can order with a code that authenticates him, that shows who is sending the code, as the president can order it, even a somewhat crazy president or a president in a mood can do that. And it may or may not, there may or may not be time in terms of who he sends it to and what the nature of it is to question that and raise a question. But he's not unlocking anything. He's just saying, I am the president and this is what you're ordered to do. He's not the only one who can do that. Many people outside Washington, if Washington is destroyed or communications are out, or even if not, can send such codes to people. That's always been true. Let me give you something that came up just Sunday. I'm struck by the fact that in Hawaii they've decided that they should have a two-man rule for sending out the alert, okay? That doesn't impress me as much as it might, because there was always a two-man rule for anything to do with nuclear weapons in terms of sending out not only alert, but execute orders, you know, and orders to launch weapons and so forth. Two men had to authenticate it at every level of command. What I found in the Pacific as a researcher for Commander-in-Chief Pacific, which I was loaned out to from RAND in 1959 and 60, was that that two-man rule was universally violated. Everywhere you turned, it was possible for one person to do that. I was also struck by the fact that they had no preparation for sending out a stop code, or, you know, reverse that. This was an error code. They weren't able to do that. It took them 38 minutes to find a way to on cell phones to send out a new order saying that ignore that, you know, inoperative. That was a mistake. Again, in the case of actual execute orders, as in the movie Dr. Strangelove, once an execute order, launch, attack order had been sent out, there was deliberately no way to authenticate a stop order. There was no stop order. I won't go through the rationales for that, mainly that the Russians might get such an order and they might stop everything. But the real rationale was the president may have second thoughts, and that would screw everything up. These chicken civilians will think twice, or maybe the other side will pretend to surrender or give in, whatever it is, you know, stop the war, limit the war, whatever, and the plan would be just totally disorganized. And so there was no stop order, as in the movie Dr. Strangelove. There was just no way to call them back. And this was at a time when most of the weapons were on planes that could take 8 to 12 hours to reach their targets. During that time, they were on the way. The train had left the station, essentially. Well, I'm just saying, all that came back to me. How different is it now? Well, different. But does Congress know what the difference is? Does the president know what the situation is? Does this president or Barack Obama know exactly how many people could give authorized orders to launch? I doubt if any president has actually known that. It's very hard to know, actually, with any confidence. More significantly, has he ever been briefed? By the way, this president seems to be impossible to brief, this particular one. It's not clear how you do it. He won't read a single page. He doesn't like diagrams. And he doesn't. He can't keep his attention, apparently, for more than minutes on a given subject if you're telling him anything. That's different from a Carter or an Obama or Hillary Clinton. But now, if we could put it on Fox News or, you know, Fox and Friends, could we get on Fox and Friends something that would get through to the president as to what the actual consequences would be of his carrying out either an attack on North Korea or a response to an alert that the Russians are attacking? A false alert, which has happened a number of times. Once at 3 in the morning, we could go in that. The classic 3 in the morning situation actually occurred in 1980. But if he were to get that, does he know exactly what would happen if he responded with that? No. In a word, no. My dream was that my book, eventually, when I worked on this years ago and a few years ago, was that it would get a Congress to investigate this. That's clearly a quixotic idea with this Congress. Mm-hmm. But how about a Democratic Congress of the kind we've had a few years ago? They didn't show any indication, any curiosity about any of this. I think if we're to change course in a way that may keep this human experiment going, it will have to be, and the U.S. will have to be in the leadership there, instead of leading in the wrong direction, as it has for so long. It will take a new Congress. It will take Democrats of a new kind, not in the past. You were, Rose, I just noticed you were in a list of leading people, activists, models of citizenship in the nation just this last week, along with a number of people in Congress. Well, fine. They're, however, in a minority. Right? And it will take a different kind of person. That will take, of course, a newly awakened citizenship. Now, if that happens, it may turn out that Trump is the one who awakened them, and then we can thank him for that.
Today we are speaking with Daniel Ellsberg, who is best known for leaking the Pentagon Papers, which played a key role in ending the Vietnam War. When he leaked these papers, he thought at the time that he would spend the rest of his life in jail, and he really could have. He did not only copy the Pentagon Papers, he also copied highly classified documents about the U.S. nuclear program. In order to keep them safe, his brother Harry buried them at a marked location in a trash dump. But a hurricane hit and destroyed the marker and the documents. Well, Daniel Ellsberg has spent his life raising awareness about this issue, and he writes about what he learned in the new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Daniel is the subject of the Oscar-nominated documentary, The Most Dangerous Man in America. It's an incredible documentary. We did a show about it. Daniel is also a key figure in the new movie, The Post. If you have any questions or comments for Daniel Ellsberg, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you are involved in the movements around nuclear weapons, we'd love to hear from you. What are your memories of the Cold War and about how decisions are made? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. I'm glad you brought up the Democrats, because when I was getting ready for the show, I was thinking about how when Obama began his first term, he promised to rid the world of nuclear weapons. But then when he ended his term, he authorized a $1 trillion with a T, plan to modernize the nuclear program over the next 30 years. He also sold more weapons than any other president since World War II, about $200 billion in weapons. You have to wonder, how much power does a president really have on these issues? I mean, who's really calling the shots when it comes to nuclear war, weapon sales, modernization? I mean, these we're talking about a lot of money here.
Well, given the exact performance that they've had, you have two questions there. Were they being totally hypocritical? Were they simply selling something? What they were going to, you know, rid the world of nuclear weapons, which they had no intention of carrying out? Or did they prove that it was a low priority, or that the obstacles were much greater? Certainly the latter, at least. I'm inclined to think that actually several of them actually did start with some vague, low-level desire to reduce the nuclear danger, which wasn't expressed in the end at all in their performance. Barack Obama essentially got a Nobel Prize for his speech in his first year in Prague, where he talked about a world free of nuclear weapons as a goal, although he already said that it wouldn't probably be in his own lifetime. That was often described as though he was the first to say that, but actually that wasn't the case at all. Reagan had used the same language, and he made a $1 trillion buildup. But that buildup had started very heavily under Carter, who again, in his inaugural talks and his first State of the Union and so forth, had talked about a world free of nuclear weapons. And yet he introduced the MX missile. He was going to have 200 of them with 10 warheads each. The cruise missiles, and we're about to get a new generation of cruise missiles now, again, of the kind that were started under Carter, air-launched cruise missiles from bombers, and sub-launch missiles and so forth. A huge buildup. And in fact, Carter again, when he left office in almost his last speech, talked about this same goal. It had almost no, there's no no correlation between what they said and what they actually did. So you're asking what's really going on. Well, certainly the fact that these weapons are not bought by us from others, but that we produce them here. Mm-hmm. It's tax money that we pay to, quote, ourselves, which has since 1980 increasingly been pretty much been the top 1% or 0.1% of people, enriching them. If there were not enormous profits plus jobs and votes and campaign donations and new careers for military officers and when they leave office and careers when they're in office as the services get bigger and bigger, I don't think we would have built these doomsday weapons. It's as if, really, we were keeping Auschwitz in good working order, on alert for when it might be used in the future for the jobs in the nearby. That's not a pejorative comparison. Each one of these weapons is a portable Auschwitz. The larger thermonuclear weapons, if you drop them near 6 million people, you kill 6 million people. Auschwitz killed about 1.2 million people in Auschwitz. Well, that's a good thermonuclear weapon right now. We're talking about, even if we were talking about retaliating to a nuclear attack, we'd be talking about retaliatory genocide. But not just genocide. If you're talking about killing 600 million people, that's not one ethnic group or one ethnic group. It's multi-genocide. And as I say, the smoke from the cities and the people, the human smoke, but mostly it's the structures that contribute the black smoke, that goes around the world and kills nearly everyone, including, by the way, even though, according to scientists like Alan Robuck and Brian Toon, who have spelled this all out in the last 10 years with new studies, total extinction is very unlikely of humans. We're so adaptable. We're so clever. We can put clothes on. We can have houses. We can have fires. We can. We're mobile. And so we can go where we can survive and eat mollusks, some of us. Less than 1%. But 1% is, 70 million people. So it's not a tiny number, but it's 1%. Other species aren't so lucky. They can't move. They will go extinct altogether. Now, not all of them. More than half of biomass in the Earth, I've learned, is microscopic, microbial, bacterial. That'll survive, largely. And some animals will survive, as in the case of the extinction of the dinosaurs. It wasn't just dinosaurs that went from the very same phenomenon as nuclear winter, by the way, when an asteroid hit the Earth and put enough dust in the atmosphere, along with a lot of volcanoes at that time, as to kill the harvests. It didn't just kill the dinosaurs. It killed everything larger than a squirrel or a raccoon. That would essentially be true now. So these other species would go. The humans would have brought about near extinction of humanity by human error, by the way. We're hearing so much since Hawaii, mm-hmm. since Sunday, about human error. What will it be when these machines are actually triggered? Will it be some careful, sane, prudent response? No, it will be a result of 70 years of building up toward that moment. Building the machinery, building the warheads, preparing, alerting, training, rehearsing, deploying, producing, making money out of building these things. And then in the end, will it have been as a result of a realistic calculation of benefit? Will it be a rational action? No, it will have to involve some terribly miscalculated notion that it's a good idea to push that button. And as I say, it's not a button in the White House, but ultimately it's a bunch of communications, of signals that are sent out, like the Hawaii signal. Apparently, in this case, there was a button on a computer. But, there will be a key. It'll be a key. The key will have been pressed by human error because it will not have been a good idea to wipe everybody out. And so human error will not only kill most humans, it will totally extinguish the other mammals. Riding over here today, thinking about looking at the news today, I was thinking, do we have any obligation to other animals? How about mosquitoes? Well, most people think, well, we could do without mosquitoes. What do they do? Ants? Well, actually, ants do a lot, as we know. They do quite a bit for us, you know, and for other things. How about mammals, though? What my granddaughter used to call the cute animals, they would go. Is that collateral damage? That would go. Do we have any obligation on those? Well, again, it's like, and again, I don't, well, I won't use the word again, but it's like immigrants from countries we don't need, in a way. That's the idea. The others. Either we come to realize that we're all in this together and that other species and other humans have value and that we have concern for them, really, there are no enemies out there that deserve the extermination we're preparing.
Daniel Ellsberg is author of the new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. We have a number of callers for you, Daniel. So let's start with Phil in San Francisco, who wants to talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. Okay. It's been wonderful to hear you, Mr. Ellsberg. Having been born in California and dealing with the Western Hemisphere, I've made notes of many items. Oh, first up, rather than genocide, how about we move forward and call it humanicide? At any rate, from Eisenhower, there was an Atoms for Peace, but it didn't go anywhere. Truman had vis-a-vis a decision of human cost to service people of Allied forces or use the devices that were available. And so he didn't lose sleep over going that way. Then what about in World War One, the war to end all wars, and how come the world wasn't more ready for the League of Nations and comment of to work in the United Nations progress? And then lastly is Neville Shoots on the beach, and what chance our country can move from representational democracy to direct democracy with representational adjunct. Side note on the first day.
Thank you, Phil. We're almost out of time.
Well, you've raised a lot of points. Yeah. Every one is relevant, every point you've raised. I'd make some small modifications in some of this. First of all, on humanicide, you invented that term. It's obviously in the right direction, except that, as I've just said, it's not only humanity that goes. And it's not all life, actually. It's a little hard, complicated to say. It's sort of all large animals, except humanity, and some humanity. John Somerville, a philosopher, coined the word omnicide. And as I've said, the death of all. It's not the death of all life, but it's an approximation. And when we talk about the death of 99% of the public, well, you could say that's of humanity. You can say, well, that's not extinction, but it's not misleading to call it omnicide, and that's what we have prepared. It definitely goes beyond genocide. On some of your other points, you mentioned World War One, but World War One so shocked people with the number of people who could be killed on the battlefield that a number of airmen, and I spend several chapters on this in the book, really developed the idea, this notion that civilians are more immune to direct attack than military doesn't make sense, because killing military by the millions, there must be something better than that. And what they thought was what we now call terrorism, that threatening and actually killing civilians would lead to smaller loss of life in the end, because the people would rise up and they would end the war. Well, it didn't work that way. It was an idea that didn't work. Actually, we killed 900,000 German civilians. That's essentially terrorism, killing civilians for a political purpose. We killed some 600,000 Japanese. I'm sorry, I reversed those. 600,000 Germans and about 900,000 Japanese civilians before the atom bombs. And when you add the atom bombs in, another 300,000 altogether, you're up to an Auschwitz worth of civilians that we burned alive, actually. They weren't gassed. The gassed inflammable chambers, the ovens, were brought to the people in their houses and in their beds, and they were burned in these. That, I believe, you can't understand our nuclear planning or the use of the bomb on Hiroshima unless you understand the pre-world there, the years of firebombing of German and Japanese cities that made our leaders think that the atom bomb itself in August of 1945 presented no moral problem because we had been doing precisely that for some 5 months earlier, killing as many Japanese civilians as possible. With it took some 300 planes a night, but we had 300 planes, and we were using them in city after city. The largest act of terrorism in human history was the night of March 9th and 10th, 1945, when we burned alive some 80 to 120,000 Japanese civilians in Tokyo. I don't think there's one American in 1,000 who's aware of that little piece of history. And after that, we tried to do the same to 64 other cities, couldn't get a firestorm going again, but we did kill up to 900,000. And then, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki simply presented themselves as something we could do with one bomb and one plane instead of 300. And that led then to nuclear plans, where we first fitted atom bombs into our regular city bombing plans, and then H-bombs, which the atom bomb, for which the atom bombs were the detonators, essentially. And there we get up to the 600 million and essentially all of it. So we've got here one. It's, in a way, you can blame humanity for this. There's, I don't think Americans are, in fact, a different species or more monstrous than others at all. But we had a different history. As an empire, and we are an empire, in most ways, we're not that different from earlier empires in the use of torture and hegemony in general, in imposing governments that serve our interests rather than others, except in one respect. We did invent the doomsday machine. We did invent the omnicide machine. And the Russians imitated us, which, by the way, is not to their credit any more than to ours. They chose, when Khrushchev was put out after the Cuban Missile Crisis, victory by the U.S., he was replaced by Brezhnev, who said to the military who had helped bring him into power, what do you want? You can have what you want. And what they wanted was what the United States Air Force had. So they built a doomsday machine, which didn't exist really until the mid-60s on the Russian side. So now there were two of them. And we now have, clearly, as we saw on Sunday, a situation where not all life on Earth, but most humanity and all of larger animal species are hostage to human error, with two doomsday machines and several smaller ones, like the India-Pakistan one and the North Korean one, all subject to human error. And I would say it is human error to have brought these devices and these systems into existence. It's human error that is keeping them going. It is human error. It was human error under Trump to be planning $1 trillion worth of these, but that plan was begun under Barack Obama, definitely. Mm-hmm. So if the world goes, the world of civilization and humanity goes, it will be as a result of a chain of human errors, a virtual network of human errors. Now, as humans, we can say, well, we created these problems. We can change them. And the word can there needs looking at, you know, we're thinking about, can we really change that much? Can we oppose, for example, mighty corporations like Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed, Martin, and all those?
Given contracts. Yeah, they're given contracts,
given the contracts
daily
contracts,
in this
right,
country with no public scrutiny and hardly any media
That's
attention.
That's right. I would say the time has really come to, well, let's put it this way. We know that the role of Exxon in not only profiting by and exploring and deploying the ability to put CO2, carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, that will raise the sea levels, you know, in the not-so-distant future at all, will change the climate altogether. We know that role now, and that's been put up. One can't say that that knowledge has had a dramatic effect because our Secretary of State is the former CEO of Exxon, mm-hmm. who actually did this. And he's the stable, mature member of the cabinet. Though the other one that is saving us, you know, is the Defense Secretary, who is the adult in the room who will save us from the doomsday machine, which, and what makes me a little uneasy is his professional nickname is Mad Dog. Mm. But that's where we are. What we haven't heard enough of, though, is those great moneymakers and job producers, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Exxon, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and so forth, Grumman, Northrop. It is time to focus on those, at least, as enemies of the survival of humanity. Mm. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, Rose, something I hadn't known before, that Obama set a record, did he, for arms sales in the world?
According to reports,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, of course, Trump just now, I'm sort of trumpeted as one of his accomplishments, an enormous contract for sales to Saudi Arabia of arms, which is being used against Yemen, by the way, in causing the greatest cholera epidemic in history and the breakdown of all this. And he's saying that means jobs. And, okay, this is almost unbearable. Thinking about what we are collaborating with in Saudi Arabia on Yemen is, I have to say, just almost unbearable to think about. Okay, can humans change this? As individuals, we know from all the people on that nation list, you, including you, Rose, and others, yes, it is possible to stand for humane values, to talk about reality and science and decency, and to work for it and to spend your lives doing it. Whether that can actually prevail against these large institutions, that remains to be seen.
Daniel Ellsberg is author of The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Find more information, yourcallradio.org. Daniel, thank you for your work. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose, for all your work.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.